Hi, I'm Philip, and welcome to Deep Tech Stories. Not many innovations have the power to shape the world on a massive scale like the internet. However, after the great financial crisis of 2007 and 8, one exactly such innovation came along, the blockchain. In late 2008, a white paper named Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system, was mailed out to a cryptographic mailing list, and only shortly after, the Bitcoin network went live. Today, 12 years after the first block, the technology is widely known, but yet barely anyone actually understands it. Not so Uli Gunnersdörfer. Uli Gunnersdörfer is a researcher at the Technical University in Munich who finished his master thesis in 2016 in precisely that topic and continued his research as a PhD student. He now stands as one of the most regarded blockchain researchers, regularly holding lectures about Bitcoin, why it is actually so safe, and answering questions about the energy dilemma revolving Bitcoin itself. However, to answer those questions, we first need to know what a blockchain actually is.
So generally, when we talk about blockchain, we have to first understand that there is a lot of cryptography behind it. So I think there are two main cryptographic methodologies. So first of all, the signature scheme. So you're able to create basically identities for yourself, so-called public keys, and have an associate private key. So private key can be somehow similar to a password. And this is the starting point for your wallet. So if you have a wallet on your mobile phone, then basically what you have is a private key and an associated public key. And this public key is what gets associated with your funds. So if I want to transfer some Bitcoins to you, you give me your public key and I can send you some Bitcoins over there. And now we have to understand how the network itself manages to handle that transaction. And the network itself is highly decentralized. So anyone can spin up their computer, anyone can run a local node, so to say. So a node is a participant in the network. And this node connects to the other parties in the network. So there are some kind of seed nodes that allow you to connect to the network in the beginning, but then afterwards you're getting introduced to new and new nodes and you get more and more connected in the network. And this network basically ensures that once I announce the transaction to you, so I created the transaction that sends you, for example, 5 Bitcoin, this transaction is broadcasted to the network. So anyone gets to know that I want to pay you 5 Bitcoin. And with that, somebody will get to know about the transaction, which we can refer to as a miner. And this miner, or all miners, are basically responsible for continuing to further develop the state of the network. So the state of the network is basically, right now I have 5 Bitcoins, you don't have any Bitcoins, but now we want to change the state to that I don't have any more Bitcoins, but you have 5 Bitcoins. And with that, these miners take the transaction and include this in the block, and they have to do a lot of computational work to create a proof of work, so to say. And if they have a sufficient work done, then this block is again published in the network. And anyone can review that and look at that and look at the transactions that are associated in this block and verify that. And anytime you see this block and see, okay, that's a good block, I like this block, looking fine, then you know you have received this 5 Bitcoin. Generally, these networks, or for transactions and for blocks, work as a gossip protocol. So anything you receive, you just forwarded to all your connected nodes, so that anyone gets to know about the blocks and the transactions that are new to the system.
Okay, so am I connected to all the nodes in there?
Not directly, but indirectly. So if you are all operating on the same Bitcoin network, then usually one node connects to 8 to 32 nodes. But overall, there are some systems that count the nodes, and it's assumed it's about 10 to 30,000 nodes in the whole network.
Is there any sort of time delay then in between? So if I go from the most possible furthest away node in between, I assume it's probably not completely instantaneous.
Yeah, so there is some time delay. There is some research about measuring that, but you don't have to forget about that block time. So the time between two blocks is set at approximately 10 minutes. So this is a protocol that we cannot really change, or that a miner cannot change. We can talk about that in a second. But given that you have 10 minutes to see what has happened in the network, that's really sufficient for anyone to get the information. Second of all, the people who are really interested in participating in the network in terms of actually mining, in terms of providing computational resources and receiving rewards for that, they are interested in to be connected as well as possible. So they are ensuring that they have very good connections to major computer centers, to major data centers. So a lot of that infrastructure is also in some kind of cloud systems, and they are very well connected to all of these systems, because if they wouldn't be that well connected, they would basically just lose money.
Okay, so as long as I don't magically end up with a block time of like a second, everything should be fine and, and dusted. Yeah, pretty much. Now you mentioned the miners and the block size. As far as I know, normal financial transactions, let's say via Visa or MasterCard, don't have that block size, or generally blocks to begin with, or miners. What is the fundamental reason for that in general?
So the main issue about decentralized networks is to agree up on a state. So as you can imagine, if we have two competing states within a network, this can easily be exploited. So for example, I convince one part of the network that I paid you 5 Bitcoin, and I have another part of the network where I paid the 5 Bitcoin to myself. And so that's possible. I can create as many public keys as I want, just for the sake of example here. And now it's the question which state is going to be the final one. So which state are we going to trust in the end? And for that, we need this consensus mechanism. And this consensus mechanism needs to operate on some kind of a data structure. And we could operate on single transactions. So that would be possible. There is no technical reason to not operate on transactions. But the good part about blockchain, or about the blocks, is that we can bundle transactions. So we can say, okay, we just incorporate 500,000, 2,000 transactions to one block, calculate the new state for these transactions, and then propose this as a next block. So as you said, as long as we do not have a block time of 1 second, that's not an issue. But if we would have transactions, we would have to need some kind of very, very short time delay between these transactions. So therefore, we do not really do this consensus protocol on a transaction level, but on a block level, and the blocks basically just bundle transactions.
And the block gets mined by the miner, which, as far as I know, is some guy somewhere with a very reasonably powerful machine that just randomly guesses the outcome of some question.
Yeah, so the person or the entity who is mining your block, or who is mining the block, is a large corporation usually. So every 10 minutes, a new block gets created, and currently 6.25 Bitcoins are paid as a reward for this block creation. So 6.25 times 54,000 US dollars, you can imagine yourself, that's a lot of money that people receive for creating such blocks. And therefore, it also requires a lot of power and a lot of computational power to create these blocks. As you can imagine that, or our research shows that about 60% of these rewards are actually spent on energy. So, and if you spend 60% of, I don't know, 300,000 US dollars every 10 minutes, then you know this is not something that happens with your local machine in your private home, but these are large corporations or large groups who connected together to create these blocks.
And when solving the riddle, or I'm assuming when, some... when,
exactly, so this is the what these miners basically do. They need to solve a so-called hash puzzle. So hashes is a way of, is a, also a cryptographic methodology to basically fingerprint data. So we can have some data, and this data has some unique fingerprint. And this fingerprint is very, very long. So we have 256 256 bytes. And these strings, so to say, this is a text, let's say that these are like 64 characters or so. And this text has to begin with an amount of zeros. So that's the difficulty. And the idea is, if you are equal likely to generate an output, so you cannot really predict what's coming out of your hash function, then you need to put an amount in there to generate such a hash function. And what basically is required, we take the block with all its transactions, and we add a nonce in there. So a nonce is a number used only once. It's basically a counter. And we try for each of these numbers to calculate the hash. And we do this so often and change this number so often until a sufficiently small hash comes out with, I think, 18 leading zeros right now is the amount that is required to propose a valid block. And further, this difficulty also changes. So in the beginning of the Bitcoin network, there were not so much computational power, but as the network increases, or the network size increases and the computational power increases, also the difficulty of this puzzle increases. So at the beginning, I think it was only 12 zeros, and then it increased steadily over time.
Okay, then I assume that it's probably rather unlikely that two entities have the same correct answer at the same time. Or how would it work if someone would have the same answer at the same time?
That's a very, very interesting question. So this can happen, and this happened in the past very rarely. So this is not something like that happens every week or so. I think the last time we have to check, 2-3 years ago. It can happen that out of pure statistics that two people find a valid answer to their solution, to their question, so to say. So as each block is unique in terms of, okay, what transaction are you including, and also the block reward, so that you are paying out the block reward to yourself, and therefore each block is different. And then it can happen that two people really find a block at the same time. But this becomes, I think it becomes more and more unlikely as the network, the computational power in the network grows.
Okay.
And what happens then, so that was your question. What happens, so basically the situation I just told you in terms of we have two conflicting states in the network, and the Bitcoin blockchain does not really care about that, because there will be a next block. There will be a block building up on each of these, or of one of these two realities, and so the longest chain itself will prevail, and the block that has not been included in the longest chain will be, so to say, orphaned, and the transactions that are in there are considered as they would have never existed. So if a transaction is in there from you, for example, then it will get included in the later block. So no worry about losing money or losing that transaction. That's just a temporary hiccup in the blockchain network, which will resolve itself when new blocks are proposed.
Okay. So I have some, I mean, obviously there can't be a block created at precisely the same time, but it's a time frame plus the translation speed in the network. And then when I have the next block, everything is fine and dandy again.
Yeah, because you have no general notion of time in a network, so you cannot really decide on a global level which of the two blocks occurred first, but you can only decide it on a local level in terms of, okay, which block have I heard of first, and you're usually building on top of that. But if you hear of a longer chain that has another block, then you just incorporate it.
And now we've talked about the proof of work algorithm, which is currently used for Bitcoin and for Ethereum. Now Ethereum, as far as I know, has been announced for quite some time now to change to proof of stake.
Yeah.
Where I have my funds and the funds do the work. If I have a node for that or I pool it with someone. That obviously that should reduce the computational load in terms of emission and electricity requirement. But how do I then still securely create new blocks without just running away and creating my own infinitely long blockchain?
Yeah. So that's a very good question. You have to think about what is the computational power. Why do we require computational power? And the reason for that is the so-called Sybil resistance. So you don't want to be able to have some entity who can just create infinite amount of blocks, as you said, and therefore we need some kind of scarce resource. We need some resource that is limited. So if I start my computer, I have one computational power of my PC, so to say. But I cannot really fake that I have 5 or 10 or 100 computers here. I have to buy them. I have to invest in them. I have to pay the energy consumption for them. I have to set them up correctly and so on and so forth. So this is the investment I have to make to be able to have this computational resource. And from a theoretical point of view, people said, okay, why do we have to have this investment first in hardware and then use this hardware to actually run the network? Why can't we just use the money as the scarce resource itself? And this is where they came up with the proof of stake system. So the competitor to proof of work, in which you are required to lock in your funds for some time. And by locking these funds in, you are allowed to propose new blocks. And the system itself is designed in such a way that it also discourages you from proposing invalid blocks. So if you would propose invalid or conflicting blocks, then it would basically slash your money or take the money that you have put into the system away from you. So this ensures that the network runs safely, that the blocks are produced at a steady rate, but ensures at the same time that there is no energy requirement such as proof of work in Bitcoin.
But the block proposal then still happens via randomly guessing a solution to a problem, or how do I propose a new block if I have my funds somewhere locked up?
That really differs from system to system. So proof of stake is something that has been in development since 2014, and there are many solutions out there. For example, some combine proof of work and proof of stake, but for Ethereum 2.0, I cannot really answer this question right now.
Now, obviously, there has been quite some talk already about the whole emission problem. And you've shared an article where a German newspaper, Spiegel, interviewed you about the emission problem. Unfortunately, that article is behind a paywall. At the same time, Google Scholar provides with the respective scientific article behind it, where you analyzed the energy consumption up until the year 2100. Based on different climate change and energy production changes up until 250 or 240. Obviously, I've only scanned through it quickly, so I'm not an expert on your own paper. You're probably much better. Can you elaborate on everything?
Yeah, so what you are talking about right now is a preprint that is actually in submission at a journal right now. And we are still waiting for the response there. So it cannot be considered as a officially peer-reviewed scientific article right now. But we have previously been publishing articles about the carbon footprint and the energy consumption of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. So our first work in 2019 was about the carbon footprint of Bitcoin. 2020, we thought about the energy consumption of alternative cryptocurrencies such as Ethereum, which also apply proof of work. And the latest piece is to guess or to build a model to estimate the energy consumption and the carbon footprint of Bitcoin up until the year 2100. So I think when we talk about this So this is a huge research area, and there's so much going on. And I think we should first start to talk about what is the complexity of estimating the energy in such a system. And because I think that's the interesting part to understand, okay, how do researchers come up with these numbers? And there are two methods basically that are applied here. The first part is some kind of a top-down approach, as I just outlined. So we just calculate the money that people are earning through mining and assuming a certain percentage as a energy cost, so to say. And this is something like the 60%. It's a very straightforward way in calculating the energy consumption if you assume some kind of electricity price, for example, 5 cents per kilowatt hour. What we do in our research is we use a bottom-up approach. So we don't think that these economic models are that precise, and therefore we decided to understand how the hash rate of the network, so we can exactly measure or we can calculate the hash rate that is required to propose every 10 minutes a block. So that's a figure you can easily calculate. And we think about how this hash rate, what kind of machines do you need to actually provide this hash rate. And what we did is we looked at IPO filings of three major hardware manufacturers and understood how much hardware they sold. And by this, we could estimate the shares of the respective machines and could assume or could calculate some kind of energy demand that these machines would have if they run in the network. And with such bottom-up approaches, you're able to have some more precise estimates than just assuming that some certain share of earnings is put into the energy system.
And then for the projection into the future, you assume the same division between the manufacturers, or?
Yeah, this methodology we used in 2019. And now for the estimation into the future, this obviously cannot hold anymore. So if you want to take a look into the future, assuming current hardware distributions is very difficult because these machines become obsolete so fast. So if we look at 2018, the machines that have been produced in 2018, they are not in use anymore. So we cannot really think about that. What we took a look at was the mining rewards and the transaction fees of Bitcoin. The problem is in Bitcoin, or maybe not the problem, but Bitcoin itself is limited to 21 million single units. So there are only 21 million Bitcoins. And that means that this block reward that I previously mentioned with the 6.25 Bitcoin halves roughly every 4 years. And with that, also, the miners itself do earn less Bitcoin. So in 4 years, the reward will only be 3 point something. And the miners, if the price does not double at the same time, then would earn less money. And what we assumed is that Bitcoin behaves from a price perspective similar to gold. So we took a look at gold and understood how gold looks in terms of how does the price fluctuate, how does the price increase over the last 30, 40 years, and assumed the same for Bitcoin, because we see Bitcoin as a store of value, or a lot of people see Bitcoin as a store of value and therefore invest in it similar to gold. And with that, we are able to estimate the rewards that miners earn, and we can assume with the 60% economic model, we can predict this in the future. Obviously, this is a lot harder, or it is a lot more imprecise than a kind of bottom-up approach, but this can give you some range within you can assume the energy consumption will take place.
Okay. And according to that preprint, everything is nice and fine if we actually manage to become climate neutral until 2050, with a big if in front.
Yeah, so I think that's the main issue with all this discussions going on. So I talked to the last weekend to people who were worried about, so this is an upcoming topic, this crypto art, NFTs, non-fungible tokens. They were worried about the energy consumption of these kind of crypto tokens. People are worried about Bitcoin, people are worried about Ethereum. The main issue I really see is not the energy consumption, but how we are, as a society, are not able to have energy sources which are carbon neutral.
Yeah, but that's a whole different topic to get in. Maybe some other day.
Yeah, that's true.
You mentioned that at the current point, Bitcoin is viewed as a store of value like gold. Now, anyone who has actually invested and knows the stock-to-flow model now has a little dollar signs in his eyes. And Bitcoin has gone through this, as physicists like to call it, phase transitions over time. So it went from this, I use it to buy my drug money kind of thing, to the idea of using it to pay for things, and now to the whole store of value part. At the same time, in 2015, if I remember correctly, Ethereum came along with the whole smart contract thing, which expands the whole idea of decentralized networks. In my naive imagination, smart contracts are really just a normal contract, but kind of automatically and secure, and I don't need a notary at the same time to check everything. Is that naive imagination correct, or am I misunderstanding something inherently wrong?
There is a famous saying that smart contracts are neither smart nor contracts within the blockchain community, and I think also the inventor of the person who have coined this term, Vitalik Buterin, the founder of Ethereum, I think he mentioned in a tweet in 2019 that he's angry at himself for naming these systems or these programs as labeling as them as smart contracts, and I agree with him to a certain extent, because smart contracts are itself, how I define them, are programs, immutable programs. So you can imagine them as a regular software you write, you install them on the blockchain, and with that they become executable, and they behave in a sense as you program them. So they are not controlled by anyone, but only by the code. And as you design the code, you can also decide how this code behaves when you execute it. And I think what most people don't understand, or what most people do not know about smart contracts, is it's more of an abstraction of the application layer of the blockchain. So the problem we had in 2014, 2013 is that the Bitcoin blockchain was mature enough, and a lot of people wanted to build systems with blockchain. And people started to spawn their own blockchains and say, okay, we're using this blockchain only for, I don't know, land registry. We want to do some kind of name system on top of a blockchain. And so hundreds and thousands of blockchains have spawned there, but they are individually not really able to sustain themselves, because you need some kind of ecosystem for them. You need to some kind of you need some exchanges which change your coins for dollars, and so on and so forth. And Vitalik had the idea to basically abstract the use case, so be it Bitcoin as a digital cash, or be some kind of land registry, or some insurance company, or some, you name it, instead of having these as separate blockchains, he wanted to incorporate them in one blockchain and abstract the functionality. And the functionality you can now use, you can put this in a smart contract and execute the smart contract and have the functionality you want secured by the Ethereum blockchain, by the underlying Ethereum blockchain. So that's the core part of this smart contract idea, abstracting the use case from the core ledger, so to say. And from that, a smart contract basically behaves as a, or it looks in the Ethereum world as a regular account. So it has an address, you can send money to it. And on top of that, you can interact with it. So you're able to say, please execute this function in here. And the smart contract does so. And depending on what you have coded or what you are putting in there, maybe the smart contract can pay out funds or some any functionality that you're really interested in.
And that then, at least for this year and beginning of last year, gave rise to the whole DeFi, so the decentralized finance part, which kind of leads over to the whole usability problem you also mentioned somewhere else, that it's quite hard for the normal citizen to get a hold of what you actually have to do to be able to participate in everything. So you have to sign up, do your whole know your customer thing, send the money over, with the money buy whatever you want. Then you have Ethereum. Ethereum you can send over to your wallet, and then the wallet you sign up for Uniswap, and then you can do all sorts of shenanigans. Has there been any progress in that in the last year since you talked about it last time?
From a usability perspective, or you mean from a general
from a usability perspective?
Ecosystem perspective. Yeah, so the usability perspective is still a front that is largely untackled, I see. So obviously there is a lot of things are going on, and people are trying to enhance the usability of the system, but it really is not suitable for an average user who says, okay, I'm able to work with Word and Excel and I know how to send an email. The experience with cryptocurrencies is a whole different, and we have so much issues in terms of alone with the idea of keeping your private key private. So to say, okay, I have a file on my computer, I need to keep it secure, or on my phone, and if I lose it or if anyone else gets it, then basically all the money or all the tokens that is associated with this address is basically gone. So people rely on, I forgot my password so much. We have so much problems with the exchanges, in terms of that exchanges try to communicate to you and say, okay, please be careful. What are you doing with the money? Where are you sending your money? And how we can receive funds for you. So for example, there is a famous example of some rapper, I forgot his name. He wanted there's a system on Ethereum, it's called the Ethereum Name Service. And the service allows you to register domains. So for example, just as google.com, you can register some kind of, uli.eth. And some user registered this domain for this rapper, and he sent this domain to the rapper. So the ownership rights, so to say, were sent to this rapper. And what did this guy do? He did not create his own wallet. He did not create he didn't manage his own keys, but he just put the deposit address of Coinbase, so the exchange that he was registered with, said, okay, you can send anything here, so to say. And obviously Coinbase is not able to process this ENS, this name service system. And now this domain is lost. It's gone. And we have to wait until, I think, 2 years until this domain gets free again. But there is no one that can actually help. And I think that is a beautiful example of why the space is from a usability perspective so bad. And a lot of people who are interested in the system who have high stakes said, okay, they invested a lot of money or they earned a lot of money through speculation, they want to go to Uniswap and so on and so forth. All these people have a high incentive to actually understand what they are doing, so they don't lose their money. But for the average user who says, okay, I have $50, there is so much mistake and so much danger to losing these funds. And from the perspective of usability, I don't think it has changed much in the last year.
Okay. And there will also no change in the next few years-ish. I mean, it is quite the technical topic, so it's rather unlikely that anything will change in the future.
Yeah, so what I believe is that we see some kind of change in terms of, okay, if my bank now would accept Bitcoin, or if my bank would be able to say, okay, Uli, I'm managing the Bitcoins for you, then I think there is some kind of change, but it also comes with a cost, of having some kind of intermediary, having some kind of entity that manages that for you. And it's obviously a risk to your system.
Yeah, and in the end, the third party is kind of the opposite of what you want in a decentralized system that you rely on. Yeah,
exactly.
Now, with the whole, the usability usually only comes with maturity in the whole space. And usually, as far as I could see, the same happens with research. So research only, or lectures on research usually only happen when the space has been mature enough and been around for a few years. And I've been wondering, you finished your master thesis in 2016, so quite far ahead of anyone. And that kind of begs the question on why was there even a master thesis to begin with in that specific topic? And why you ultimately decided on continuing research instead of doing some company in the space?
Yeah, so the question about the master thesis was highly interesting. So I think some people will hate me for what I'm saying right now, but I selected my thesis supervisor because of sympathy. So I thought this is some kind of area I want to work in. It was software engineering, and I knew that I can work with this person very well. I knew him beforehand from a other course. And we discussed several topics, and he has a lot of background in natural language processing. So he did a lot of research on how do people read contracts, or how can computer read contracts, so legal contracts. The question arose, okay, now there is some kind of paradigm that we read somewhere about, and it's called smart contracts. And we had both no idea about what this is about, what this thing is about, what is blockchain. We had absolutely no idea, and said, okay, let's understand how smart contracts can facilitate legal contracts, or how do they pose a danger to legal contracts, and how will the future look like in that regard. And with that question in mind, we started the master thesis, and quickly I took the deep dive into blockchain and Bitcoin and Ethereum and smart contract and all the associated technologies there. And I think after 2 weeks or 4 weeks, we were fully in the topic, and was totally hyped and totally flashed by all these concepts and about these ideas and what is going on there. And this really made the decision for me to continue in this area so much easier, because I have been doing multiple things at the university, and I saw a lot of stuff in IT, it really where I had the most fun and I was most intrigued was really the decentralized systems part.
And then, based on that, like, was there any notion of going into the industry in the whole crypto scene at all, or just straight from master to PhD without any further consideration?
So I started my master thesis in 2016, and I actually finished in 2017. And then I think I had 2 or 3 months of free time before I started my dissertation or my PhD. I thought about going into the industry, but the main issue for me was to be able to produce some kind of billable income, or produce some kind of results that could create money, so to say. And for me, I wanted to better understand what was going on in the technology, and I wanted to understand how these systems work, how we can support the systems, how these systems can support business processes, for example. And for that, I thought research was the the bad idea. And I really liked the university setting. I liked working with students, or I liked being a student myself. And I thought it would be a good idea to, so to say, switch the sides of the table and work on the other side. And that really was I was so lucky to have this kind of support at the university. So being able as a PhD student to create your own lectures, I think that is not very often. So this happens very rarely. And the people I got to know and the networks I got connected to, and also getting some kind of publicity in this whole community and over this community. So as you mentioned, the Spiegel article, for example, this is something that wouldn't really have happened, I think, if I directly would have joined and the industry. And right now I have my network, I have many students. And if after the university I wanna kick something off in the blockchain space, I think there are a lot of people who I could collaborate with or who I could work with.
You mentioned the business space and the impact on it. There was also a possible preprint or actual peer reviewed paper by now about the smart contracts in legal space, and I saw something on LinkedIn a while ago, which kind of went viral-ish in the German space, that someone just posted a picture of a flowchart, and on top of the flowchart said, "Do we need a blockchain?" And then arrow pointing down just said, "No." So has there been any interest from the public sector about what's going on, or nothing at all so far?
So we see a lot of discussion. So the problem of finding a good bit of a good blockchain use case is, I think, that's prevalent since 2016. Since I started working on this topic, a lot of people discuss use cases that, from my point of view, do not really make sense. So that happens until now, but we see use cases kicking off, for example, in the education sector. So the IHK in Munich in Bavaria, they started working on a, or they did not start working, they built and finalized a prototype, a blockchain where they are allowed to issue their own certificates. So the IHK is basically giving a lot of certificates for handymen and so on, and they can now issue and verify these certificates using a blockchain, for example. This is one example that the public administration actually has an interest in. And for example, also the state minister for digitalization in Bavaria, they also have kicked off an institution called the BC Squared, the blockchains, the Bavarian Center for Blockchain Competence, and they are all really working on getting the technology more in use, more used in the public sector. But still, we are in a very, very early stage in that regard. And I think, from my personal opinion, I think blockchain has a lot of advantages, especially in the financial sector. So as you said, decentralized finance, lending protocols, these kind of things. I think this is something that really, really will have a future.
Yeah, I'm quite surprised, actually, because, I mean, coming from Bavaria, from very rural Bavaria, I did not expect anything to be happening, to be honest.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't expect this from the CSU, the state party, so to say. I'm also very surprised, and I'm very surprised the community is there, and also Munich has a lot of big enterprises and industries which are interested in. So a lot of big insurance companies, automotive manufacturers, and so on and so forth, and they are all actively dipping their fingers into the technology.
How many are of them sending their engineers to go through your lecture series that you created?
So I actually don't know, because we made this open source so anyone can use it, and we put it on GitHub. But at the same time, we are running a program at the TUM Institute for Lifelong Learning. And this is a institution basically that comes from this, that offers these MBA programs. And we have a 5 ECTS course for managers called Certified Blockchain and Distributed Ledger Technology Manager. And this is a fully booked course every half year, where we are also where are discussions going on with big enterprises if they can book this course solely for them, and so on and so forth. So this is really, especially in the educational perspective, we see currently a lot of demand. Yeah.
No, it's just, I have this very old school Bavarian image in my head.
Yeah, and it still is true in some regard, but and I think there are also a lot of other countries or towns, Berlin, for example, that are ahead of us. But Munich is a good example, I think.
Now to get back to, so you mentioned that you had a deep dive within 2 or 4 weeks of everything Bitcoin and smart contracts, and probably also went through the code. Oh, well, you definitely went through the code. And you mentioned that you mentioned in another interview that when you went through the code, there were a few parts in there that confused you because they were solved too complex. And then later on, you noticed why they were solved that complex, or that they gave rise to a certain idea like smart contracts. Can you explain what those particular design choices were?
Yeah. So there is one concept in there. It's called the transaction-based ledger and Bitcoin script. So I told you beforehand that if I send you 5 Bitcoins, I send this to your public key. This is not entirely correct. I actually send it to a small piece of code that requires you to provide some information. So it basically does not say this public key gets it, but it's the person who is able to provide a signature for this is able to retrieve the money. And the transaction-based ledger is, so to say, the way that Bitcoin stores these programs. And with this Bitcoin script, you can achieve incredible complexity. So Bitcoin script, you could, so for simplicity, if we just want to use the public key, we could just really say, okay, we have some kind of column, we store the public key in there, and then you're fine. But for example, a concept arose with this Bitcoin script called N out of M multi-signature. So you require, for example, 3 out of 5 signatures to spend some money. So for example, you could imagine you are the CEO of a company, and or you own a company, and you own this company together with another party or with 2 other parties, and you want that no one is able to spend the money just on its own, but that people have to collectively agree on that. And it does not really matter the 2 out of the 3 signatures, which of these 2 out of 3 signatures are actually there. And this is some kind of concept that is not really known to some kind of banking, or that you have a hard time discussing with your local bank to establish that. And with this multi-signature wallets, there are so many crazy ideas starting from that. So for example, the idea of a payment channel. So imagine following scenario. So you are local newspaper, and I want to read articles with you. I don't want to register I don't want to pay the whole magazine. I just want to read single articles. And now we can agree that I pay you 10 cents for an article. And with that, if we would issue every time a transaction on the blockchain, it would take enormous, it wouldn't just make sense because of the transaction fees, the network gets congested, and so on and so forth. So what we can do is we can create a multi-signature wallet where I pay in 1 Bitcoin, and I sign, so to say, an agreement that I'm willing to pay you 10 cents, 20 cents, 30 cents, and so on for each article you provide me. And this commitment that you receive from, you can cash this in on the blockchain anytime you want. So I cannot cash in the money because I require a signature, but I give you, for every article I read, I give you signatures. And with that, we're basically able to say, okay, I don't know how much articles I'm going to read, but with that, we can basically put the transactions, these multiple transactions, into one single transaction. And to top it all up, this is the basis of layer two. So this is the basis for putting money off the blockchain, inserting this into new mechanisms, into new systems that allow you to actually transfer money securely, trustless, without any third party and without talking to the blockchain, and without incurring the boundaries of the blockchain, so to say. You're not limited transactions fee, you do not require to write this down to the blockchain, so to say, and congest the network. And this is some kind of where I thought, okay, what is this complexity of this transaction-based ledger, and why did they do this in Bitcoin script? What a waste of complexity. And then it clicked and I understood, okay, this is really the basis for entire new networks, just because someone said, okay, let's parameterize this a little bit because we could use it later on. And this is really a truly beautiful solution.
And that's then the Lightning network in the case of Bitcoin.
Exactly. That's the bootstrapping of the Lightning network. If someone would have said, okay, fuck Bitcoin script, we don't need that, then there wouldn't be a Lightning network. Nope. Yeah. So that's really, and this rabbit hole is so deep and so crazy, and what's going on and what people are talking about. And this is what I really like about the space, that you, even me, I'm working for 4 years full time on blockchain or crypto, that there is every day I wake up and I'm certain that I will see something, some new ideas, some new concept that you have never seen before.
I will come back to that after the next question. So if I have my layer two and I can send funds back and forth between certain private keys, certain accounts, without having to bother the actual blockchain, how do I keep up with everything? How does the blockchain know what happened, and how does everyone else know what happened?
So basically what you're doing is when you're using Lightning, for example, and I have to say, I'm not an expert on Lightning Network yet. This is a complete own world that I have not the chance to dive in that deep. But basically what you do is you lock in your funds in this multi-sig, in this contracts, in this payment channels. And for the blockchain itself, all the funds are locked and cannot be used otherwise. And this opens up, so when you lock the money, this opens up this payment channel. And with this payment channel, you can send funds, you can receive funds, and there are two potential ways to close these funds. Either some party is malicious and tries to somehow tamper with the transaction, so to say. Then other parties can say, okay, that's it, we're closing this payment channel, I don't trust you anymore. Go back to the blockchain, and the blockchain, basically the issue is resolved, and the funds are given to the rightful owner. Or if you say, okay, I'm done with the system, I just want to get back to the blockchain, then you can just close it on your own and take the money that you have received in the meantime in there. But the blockchain does not really need to keep up, because when the payment channel is closed, then the state, so to say, is resolved on the blockchain.
Okay, so as long as the channel is open, I can do, well, not whatever I want, but it doesn't bother the blockchain. And then in the end, the moment I close the channel, everything is updated and everyone knows about it.
Exactly, doesn't bother the blockchain.
Now, back to before. You said that every day you get up and you can be sure that something mad is going to come across you. How do you then decide on your paper topics, the hypothesis that you want to pursue?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So obviously you have the ability to work on short-term ideas. So I have the capability to supervise students. I am able to give out topics to master students. And this is something that I really enjoyed over the last years, having some small ideas and giving them to some students. For obviously, when you conduct a PhD or you want to write your dissertation, then you have to think about a long-term goal you are working towards. And for me, it has to do, or for my dissertation topic, it was all about identity management and how can we ensure that a public key is actually belonging to the legal entity we are thinking about. And I found some kind of niche in there. So basically, there is a lot of unresearched areas in the blockchain, scientific area, so to say. And I found my niche there and decided to say, okay, this is where I'm going to work on, and where I'm also quite certain that the amount of other people working on that area is not that high, so that you won't get outrun, so to say. But this has happened. So we had some paper ideas. I had master thesis aligned where I said, okay, I wanna understand that concept. I wanna find some metric. I wanna find some methodology. And we started discussing with the students. And a month later, we have some kind of preprint in my email, my inbox, where I see, okay, damn, someone else has been faster than us. That especially really happens when you have some high demand areas, or where the ideas, was my case, where the idea was really at hand, and it was basically kind, okay, someone has to do it, and they were faster than us.
At least a sign of you're not in the wrong research area.
Exactly. So you always have to see it from a positive perspective, and I connected to the researchers, and they are all, so I think this is also a research community where people are very nice and are happy to share their ideas and talk about how you can collaborate. So I think there's always some kind of positivity there.
Besides you guys in Munich, is there anyone else that you find particularly notable in the whole research space?
Oh, there are plenty. So from a research output perspective, I think that TU Munich is not that big in the system. But for example, there are, for example, Uni Innsbruck, very strong. They have a very high valued professor, Rainer Böhme, who has a lot of output in this area. But also I would say there are so many universities, and it really depends on what you are exactly looking at. So for example, Professor Philipp Sandner, who's famously cited in German newspapers, is an economics professor at the Frankfurt Business School. But if you look at, for example, at cryptography, you have to take a look at, for example, Stanford. But there are so many high value universities. That's really insane, yeah.
Okay, but you just type in something to Google Scholar and see what pops up.
Exactly.
Thank you very much for being with me then.
Thank you for the invitation.
See you in Munich the next time we are allowed to travel.
Looking forward to that.
Hi, Philipp here. Before you leave, I just wanted to thank you for listening, and I hope you learned something in this episode. If that is the case, why not message me at philip@deeptechstories.io. I'm always curious about what you took away and look forward to a discussion with you. That is philipp@deeptechstories.io. It would also help me out a great deal if you could recommend the episode to a friend of yours that might find it interesting as well. See you again next time when I talk with Robert Schmidt about the next revolution in agriculture, precision farming.